This is All Sides with Amy Jurevich, and this is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Highlights for Children magazine, that staple of childhood, has grown into a global operation, with more than 1.4 billion issues printed and business operations based in Columbus. But nearly 65 years ago, an airline collision rocked the founding family of the magazine and gave rise decades later to a new memoir about living in the shadow of loss and grief, written by the granddaughter of the company's executives who died. Joining us now is Marty Ross Dolan, a retired child and adolescent psychiatrist and a writer. Her memoir is titled Always There, Always Gone, A Daughter's Search for Truth. Welcome to All Sides, Marty.
Thank you so much, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here.
And congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Now, before we talk about the memoir in detail, I wanted to start by talking about your family tree a little bit in the magazine. Highlights for Children, more commonly known as just Highlights, has that distinctive red banner and the tagline, Fun with a Purpose. It's a familiar magazine that many remember from childhood or from reading it with their own children or grandchildren. It was founded by your great-grandparents, Dr. Gary Cleveland Myers Sr. and Carolyn Clark Myers. And they were pioneers in the field of education. Can you tell us a little bit more about them?
Yeah, they were very passionate about what they saw as their dream to have a magazine for children. They worked with another magazine and were editors prior to Highlights with a magazine called Children's Activities. And then when they had the opportunity, actually in their retirement age, in their 60s, they chose to put all of their efforts into creating the new magazine called Highlights for Children. And they remained involved until their deaths in the 1970s, 1980. So they are the founders, and they remain very, very important to the family.
And they had three children, and the youngest child, Gary Jr., was your grandfather. Do I have
right.
this correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then he and his wife, Mary, were the executives at Highlights. They served from 1950 to 1960.
That's right.
Okay. So in the first chapter of your memoir, it's dated December 16th, 1960. So that's the date your grandparents boarded an ill-fated TWA flight leaving Columbus. Can you tell me what happened?
So they were on their way to New York City for a meeting to talk about placing Highlights on the newsstands. Mm. And TWA Super Constellation. And as it was coming into land at LaGuardia, a United flight from Chicago was coming in to land actually at Idlewild, which is Kennedy now. Mm. And so the United plane got off course and the planes collided, and all of the people on both planes lost their lives. One plane, the United plane, landed in Brooklyn in Park Slope and killed people on the ground. So that's sort of the more known part of the accident. My grandparents' plane landed at an empty airfield in Staten Island. The plane originated from Dayton, but most of the people were from Columbus or the central Ohio area.
Now, when your grandparents were killed, your mother and her four siblings were orphaned. Your mother was 14 at the time. So who ended up raising them?
So they moved to Austin, Texas, to live with my grandfather, my mother's father's older brother, and his wife and their four daughters. One daughter was married and not living in the house, but it was a large family all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And they moved. My mother was 14, and she finished her high school in Austin, and as did the other four siblings, continued on with school there.
So obviously, you never had the chance to meet them, but you're named for your grandmother, mm-hmm. And their deaths were just basically overshadowed your childhood, right? Can you tell us the effect and the influence on your mother? She was 19 when you were born, so it was just five short years. You were born, she became a mother 5 short years after losing her mother.
Right, yeah. Right. So I was very, you know, I was aware early as a young child that my grandparents, obviously I didn't have a set of grandparents on my mother's side, and that my mother struggled when talking about them, would become tearful. And I also knew that the topic was not a topic to talk about. I definitely grew up learning stories about my grandparents, wonderful stories. But their cause of death and the story around their death, we just didn't talk about it.
So you knew they died, but you didn't necessarily know how they died?
I knew that they had died in an airplane accident, but I just didn't have information. And I was just always sort of searching in my head for what might have happened, but never really able to talk about it. And it's not like it was something that I was walking around with 24/7, you know.
Yeah.
But it was definitely part of my existence and part of my relationship with my mother.
Mm. And did you grow up in Texas?
No, my mom went to college at Oberlin in Ohio.
So she wanted to come back to Ohio.
She came back to Ohio, met my father, and then we moved to Buffalo, New York, and then to outside of Boston. And ultimately, I was raised in South Carolina, where my father was doing Army, spending time in doing 2 years in the Army, and continued and was raised there.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides, and we're talking with author Marty Ross Dolan, a retired child and adolescent psychiatrist and a writer. Her memoir is titled Always There, Always Gone, A Daughter's Search for Truth. So you went to great lengths to protect your mother. You would shield her from information you didn't learn until much more recently. Was that always a conscious decision on your part, that you didn't want her to know things that you were learning?
I always was. It's an interesting question, because it's never been a secret, but I had always avoided her. I tried to avoid her getting upset, and I knew what upset her. So as I was learning, because I was had discovered on the internet that there was a lot of information about this airplane accident, I didn't let her know I was learning about it. It just wasn't necessary. And it wasn't until the 50th anniversary of the airplane accident in 2010 that it became a topic of conversation, because there was a memorial that took place in Brooklyn, and it was a national news story.
Now, did your mom kind of block it out as a defense mechanism, because she was 14 and suddenly lost her parents, you know, in a tragic way, in a very unexpected way? Or did she always have it there and just never talk about it?
You know, I think, so when this happened in 1960, it was a different time when it comes to talking about things like tragedies and death and grief. And so she was raised in following the loss of her parents in a situation where everybody was moving forward. They said soldiering on, not talking about it. They didn't talk about it. So in many ways, I think that's what led to some of the challenges that I had, because it was the same kind of silence around it. And yet, as time has passed and the decades have moved on, we have more language for grief. We have ways to talk about it. There's therapy there. People, it's not taboo. And so I think a lot of people, you know, I listened a couple of weeks ago. You had Pat Wynn Brown, and she was talking about her father and his mental illness.
She wrote a memoir as well about
her life. Yeah. That's right. Mm-hmm. It was so similar. And she was talking about how the family didn't talk about it, and she had to go and figure it out herself, what happened and to him. And so I think that whether or not she was carrying it around with her and just didn't want to talk about it, or it was just the way it was in her mind, I think the silence in many ways was more of the trauma than the actual loss.
Hmm. So is this why you became a psychiatrist? you knew you're laughing because you knew I was going to ask you that, right?
Well, I became a psychiatrist, I think, because I just have a very deep interest in human behavior and emotions. Sure, I think that I was a sensitive, have always been sensitive to how others are feeling. And so I think it was a natural sort of thing for me to pursue. I don't practice anymore. But I will say that my training and who I am as a psychiatrist informs just about everything that I think and do. And so I think it definitely informs how I approached this book and this story.
Mm. Yeah, you your parents ended up divorcing, and you write, I'm quoting you here, I often wonder if my parents' divorce would have been so traumatic for me had I already known about the power of protracted grief. With all the effort I had to put into containing my mother's despair, I was doing a lousy job of containing my own.
Yeah.
So you didn't really know how to react to your parents' divorce because you were worried about your mom's emotions, right?
I was, that's an interesting way to think about it. My own trauma was the divorce, mm-hmm. my own personal trauma. So, but I was already existing in a state where loss of parents was sort of front of mind anyways. Mm-hmm. So it just complicated in a lot of ways how I was thinking about loss. But I was also young. I was 10. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I was really able to process. But in retrospect, that's how I see it.
Right. It took you many years to write this memoir. What prompted you to write it now and get it out there?
Mm. So I started writing at right after the 50th memorial event in 2010. I wrote an essay. I wrote that essay as part of that I presented to a class here at OSU that I took. And the professor told me that he thought that I was writing a book. And that it wasn't just something that could fit into an essay, but it needed to be book length. And my reaction to that was to go home and put the whole thing into a cabinet and let it be, because I didn't want to write a book.
I see.
And so it took, at the same time, my mom was getting access to my grandmother's personal letters, and I wanted those. I wanted to know more about her. And so I started sort of gathering those letters in my basement. And when the pandemic happened, it sort of all kind of made sense. When I had this essay in a cabinet, I had this treasure trove of letters in my basement, and I had a lot of time. And I also wanted to pursue an MFA, and I was able to do that in a remote way through the school that I went to. So all of that together made it possible for me to say, okay, now I'm writing this book.
Now, you said that this 50th anniversary event kind of spurred you to write the essay, get started on this process.
Mm-hmm.
There was an outpouring response, related to the 50th anniversary, because there was coverage in the New York Times. You mm-hmm. know, the Columbus Dispatch did coverage of it.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother was struck by one response in particular. She heard from a man who was also orphaned when his parents died on the United flight. Was that a connection that she probably needed a long time ago?
It's very possible. That was a real moment of real eye-opening moment of discovery, that where I had been feeling so alone and imagining that she was feeling alone, there was actually just a whole host of people, I call them my strangers, who had the same story. And that was a remarkable week, to read all of those accounts that people, in the blog, that was a New York Times sort of blog over the week of collecting people's accounts from the accident. And I think it was a discovery for her that sort of maybe opened her eyes to see that there was another family. And had it been 2025, maybe those families could have connected. Mm-hmm. Maybe there would have been a way to have support across the victims' families, but that was a different time.
Yeah. Now, losing two executives in a sudden plane accident, that could have been devastating for Highlights. I mean, mm-hmm. it could have taken the company under, but Highlights is still here.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that process? I'm guessing someone else in the family took over.
Well, and it was actually, we lost three executives. There was an additional person who was working for Highlights that also was on the plane. Definitely devastating, but my great grandparents were still very involved.
Mm-hmm.
My great aunt and my great uncle, my grandfather's siblings, were very involved, and so the presence of family and also very dedicated employees decided that this was going to take a short toll not so short for the family, but short for the business. Like we were gonna, it's just a soldiering on, moving forward. And Highlights is a mission driven company. We are just the devotion is to our children, readers, and so it's the idea that it wouldn't exist and wasn't going to continue to serve children around all over the world that wasn't an option.
Are you currently involved with Highlights Magazine? Is it still a family business?
It's still a family business. I'm a member of the fourth generation. We have a sixth generation. We have, I believe, three babies in the sixth generation. I think that's right. And maybe four. I have to think about it. But we meet every summer in July as a family to sort of continue our education of the family and dedicate ourselves to the mission of the company. And my involvement is I'm not an employee, but I'm very family involved.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, telling us the story, telling us about your memoir. That was Marty Ross-Dolan, and her memoir is titled Always There, Always Gone, A Daughter's Search for Truth. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. Pleasure.
And coming up, we're going to be talking with a jazz drummer. That's when Fascinating Ohio continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you were going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Our next Fascinating Ohioan is jazz drummer Jim Rupp. In addition to teaching at Ohio State in the Jazz Studies Department of the School of Music, he plays with the Columbus and Cleveland Jazz Orchestras, as well as the Cleveland Pops Orchestra. He is royalty in the jazz world, having played with legends like Ray Charles, Maynard Ferguson, and the Glenn Miller Orchestra. Jim Rupp, welcome to All Sides.
Oh, thank you for having me, Amy. Happy to be here.
So what made you start drumming? When did you start?
I think in fourth grade, I remember sitting and watching a Memorial Day parade and the drummers went by and I thought that looked fun and started in band then. But then I came from a really good high school jazz program, Glenwood High School, Canton, Ohio. Great band director up there, Joe Michigee, who's still alive, just turned 90.
Oh, wow.
And Joe took us to Moonlight Ballroom to hear the Count Basie Orchestra. And I remember sitting in front of that stage thinking, I want to do this. This is, great. I was in the marching band, concert band, and the jazz band. So I thought, this is great. And it's funny, years later, when I was traveling with Diane Schur, we did a couple nights with the Count Basie Orchestra where I played drums behind her. And I thought, ooh, this is where I wanted to be years ago. So,
oh, you had a full circle moment?
Full circle moment, exactly.
Now, drumming as a child, I'm sure that's every parent's dream come true, right? Drummer in the house.
Well, yeah, my dad wasn't real thrilled. Matter of fact, there was a little joke was in our home that my dad didn't want to go buy me drums. And my mom said, Howard, go buy him a pair of sticks, a pad, and a book. It'll cost you $10 and he'll be done with it in 3 weeks. And, years later, I'm in college practicing hours a day in the summer. And he came into the kitchen and said, oh, yeah, Gladys, three weeks later, we won't hear anything more about it. But I do remember Mom told me one time I was on the Arsenio Hall show with Tony Bennett, and all of a sudden he kind of, because, my parents came from Pickens, West Virginia, graduating class of three, through the Depression, World War II. They're thinking their son wants to be a musician. It isn't the easiest life in the world. I get it, where they were coming from, but
yeah. But you seem to have made a career of it a little bit.
Yeah, but, interesting moment, because I came to Ohio State in 74 as pre-vet. And I remember there were, and I just.
Oh, wait, you wanted to be a vet.
I was wanted to be a pre-vet because, okay. my parents were encouraging me to have a more traditional career. My high school girlfriend, and I get it. And I went, they used to have this class called UVC that all the pre-vet majors would meet one day a week, you know, pre-med. And I remember going into this West Campus meeting room, and there was Dean Mount of the vet school, and he was right. This was a great moment for me, but he said, statistics tell us there are 268 of you pre-vet students in this room right now. 12 of you will make it through vet school.
Ooh.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's intimidating.
This is not what I want to do. I want to play music. I want to be a musician and teach. And I immediately went over and, you know, changed and never looked back. I said, my chances are probably better as a drummer than they are as a pre-vet major.
Apparently, yeah.
Right.
Well, you've toured and played with just a couple of bands, to say the least. What has been the one that has that you've stayed with the longest? Who have you drummed with the longest?
Probably Woody Herman's band that I was on and off frequently. My initial stretch was probably, 10 months or something like that. Mm-hmm. But then on and off because a band would need subs. But road bands back in those days, you know, you'd be on the road constantly, maybe a few weeks off in the summer, maybe 3 weeks or so at Christmas. Other than that, you're on a tour bus. Mm. So, you know, my wife's a gem. I always kid her, the drummers, we marry the most intelligent, amazing, and beautiful women, but it takes a special woman to be married to a musician in general. You're gone a lot.
You played both big bands and small group settings.
Yeah.
Do you have a preference between the two? Do you like big bands or small groups better?
I really feel blessed now in my career because I do the Cleveland Pops Orchestra. Mm-hmm. Like this weekend, we're doing a Sinatra concert. I go to Dayton Symphony Saturday to do a Pops concert with a great singer, Ann Hampton Calloway. Mm. And I do a lot of Byron Stripling's Pops concerts. So now I'm doing these kind of orchestra gigs and these big band gigs, but I still do a lot of small group playing. And I feel very blessed and fortunate to, you know, it keeps it interesting.
And you like both?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
Here, we have a cut of you playing. I wanted to play that.
Start believing in you. Let him hold out his hand. Let him touch you and watch what happens. Want someone who can look.
Now, what were we listening to there?
That was the Cleveland Jazz Orchestra. Great mm-hmm. singer up there, Evelyn Wright. And that was a live record we did, I'm going to say 5 years ago. Sean mm-hmm. Jones was maybe a little longer than that. Sean Jones was leading the band, great trumpeter. Mm-hmm. That's a great group, very creative writing, and I'm fortunate to do it and the Columbus sometimes, mm-hmm. both fun organizations.
Tell me what it's like when, you know, people come to see the lead singer, people come, you know, then, but you're the drummer, but the drummer is noticeable, but also sometimes behind the scenes. What is it like being both? Because everyone usually can hear the drums, but whether you're supposed to or not depends on the music, right?
Yeah, you know, I think a drummer's role mostly is supportive. You want to be there, and that requires a different gear. You know, if I'm in a small group or an orchestra, I use different cymbals and little setup for each. And I always tell my students, you're the quarterback in any group, and you're mm-hmm. setting the volume level, mm-hmm. the style. Sometimes you have to be very supportive. Sometimes you've got to, you know, take the bull by the horns and make things happen if they're not. Mm-hmm. And that just requires, I think, confidence and experience. So, I don't know. Yeah. There you go.
You work with Columbus Percussion. That's a percussion store here in Columbus.
Yeah.
Can you tell me more about that store?
Sure. It was 1981. And, you know, my partner at the time, longtime friend, ran a great department at Capital University, just recently retired, Bob Breithop. You know, he was part-time at Capital, and I was on and off the road. And we thought, you know, this town could really use a drum shop. Mm. And I think it was 5 years before we actually made a dime out of the store. Mm. But, you know, I've been very fortunate again and blessed to have a great crew of people there. You know, I'm really fortunate now. My son is a great man. He's a much better businessman than I am. He's there. And my wife's our bookkeeper. So it's very much a family business. But We're about 50-50 between school business and professional business, and we do all over the country, actually all the world. We just sent stuff to Japan.
Mm. They come to you. Yes.
Yeah.
I saw some videos of you from Columbus Percussion, like, on a YouTube page, I guess, where you're giving people kind of a tour of some vintage drums. Do you have some good pieces in?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love the history of the instrument and the music, but... You know, it's fun to me. This is like, we just got a beautiful Gretsch kit in from the probably mid early 60s, and it's a pretty rough shape. So we're going to have to restore that, and it's a lot of fun knowing the history and how to bring these great instruments back to life.
And in addition to selling instruments, do customers come into your shop for advice? Do they come talk to you about the music business or how to be a drummer?
Yeah, I mean, I always say, if you graduate from Ohio State in the vet school, you know, mm-hmm. you get this job and it pays this much and here are your health benefits and, you know, there you go. Being a musician, it's different, mm-hmm. you know. But I have students who've graduated with me. I'm very, again, fortunate to have a couple guys in New York, a guy in Nashville, a couple of people in Cleveland, some people here in town that are working musicians you probably mm-hmm. haven't heard of, but they're... You know, this is a people business, the music mm-hmm. business. And, you know, if you've got those skills and people skills, you know, I'm a big fan of coaches' books. Like, I've read Urban Meyer's book and Jim Tressel's mm-hmm. book. And I haven't read Woody Hayes, who was coach but I just love his title, You Win With People.
Yeah.
And I think that's very true. People want to hire people that they like being around, who bring positive energy to whatever they're doing.
Do you have parents who come into the shop just to get a pad and some sticks? And,
oh, yeah.
And it's just going to be a 3-week process?
Yeah, yep, absolutely. That's my favorite thing of those beginners. You know, mm-hmm. I see the light in their eyes. They're buying that first sticks or drum set. And I go back to when I was a kid and excited to get that first drum set. That, you know.
Can you set a kid in front of a drum set and tell whether they got it or not, if they can get the beat quickly?
Or maybe you
want to say you can teach everyone. Yeah.
I like to think... You know, when I taught privately, just private students years ago, I didn't care whether somebody wanted to be a professional musician. I just wanted to know they liked it and they worked at it and they enjoyed it. Obviously, now at Ohio State, it's different. You're telling me you want to be a career out of this. Mm-hmm. I do want to see. Is this person have both the talent and the work ethic, which is work ethic is actually more important. Mm-hmm. Do you have that determination, grit, and work ethic to get through the rough times and stuff like that? Yeah.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides, and we're talking with Jim Rupp, who teaches in the Ohio State Jazz Studies Department of the School of Music. He also plays in the Columbus and Cleveland Jazz Orchestras, as well as the Cleveland Pops Orchestra. Now, no doubt you have influenced generations of musicians. When mentoring or speaking with other musicians, what do you like to get across to them about performing, about living a life as a musician? What do you tell them?
What do I tell them? You have to be resourceful. Mm-hmm. You know, it's common for musicians, you know, like myself, I've got a busy career playing. I've got a drum shop. I teach half-time at Ohio State. Situations like that are fairly common. You know, usually you think, oh, you want to be a musician. You think of somebody in the Cleveland Orchestra or jazz at Lincoln Center. But there are musicians all over the country who are leading, you know, fulfilling lives and buying homes and raising families who you haven't heard of. Mm. And so I think, you know, you've got to be resourceful. It's not as easy as being a graduate from the dental school or the vet mm-hmm. school or accounting or something like that. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned you drummed on the Arsenio Hall show. Has drumming taken you on TV more than just that time?
Yeah, with Diane, I traveled with jazz singer Diane Schur for about 9 years, mm-hmm. and we did numerous TV shows, and both domestically and around the world and stuff. And that was a great time also, mm-hmm. and that was a good period too, because usually that was a few days or a few weeks in Europe, and you know, I'm very fortunate to have a beautiful family, great kids, and now grandkids. Mm-hmm. And so I wasn't gone on those long stretches, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, not big long tours, just little like snippets here and there. Okay. Yeah. And I mentioned at the beginning that many consider you royalty in the jazz world, you know, with all your drumming.
I'm not so sure I'd feel that way.
Well, that's what I was told whenever someone recommended that I talk to you. Maybe
that just means I've been around a long time, I guess, yeah.
Well, then if that's what it takes to be royal, then just embrace it. Okay. I mentioned at the beginning that you played with Ray Charles. What was that like?
Oh, I really enjoyed, and Ray was famous for being hard on drummers. I backed him numerous times when I was on Woody Herman's band. We did some TV shows and other events. And Ray's way of counting, and this is one of the great artists of our time. I loved working with Ray. But Ray wanted you to take his tempos. But I also knew, and I tell my students this, who's paying you? I was on Woody Herman's band, not Ray Charles' band. We backed Ray numerous times.
I see.
So I took Ray's tempos, but I felt like I'm going to keep these tempos for the band and for Woody. And I must have done a good job, but a couple of days later, Ray's management called up and said, hey, Ray liked your drumming. Do you want to come on the road? And I was honored to be asked, but I had only been on Woody's band, I think, a few months. And that was a lifelong dream of me to play with Woody Herman. So timing was not good.
Okay. It's not that you turned down Ray Charles. It was just bad timing.
Bad timing.
I got it. Yeah. Bringing it back to Ohio and Columbus, where does Columbus fit into the jazz world? What's it like playing here for audiences here?
Oh, this is a great jazz town. There are a lot of great players. Oh, my golly. You know, the Columbus Jazz Orchestra and the Jazz Arts Group, that's an incredible resource here. The Wexner Center, you know, that's one of the things I tell recruits. I always say my job in the School of Music for Ohio State is the same thing Ryan Day has to do for the football team. I've got to, you know, recruit great talent, help develop them to that next level, and help them succeed in the pros. And one of the advantages I have to sell is this town. You know, there's the Tuesday night jam session at Park Street. You know, Vaughn Weister's not doing it right now, but that long-running big band thing Vaughn had on Monday nights. There's some killing players in this town. Drummers, oh my golly, you know, Reggie Jackson, James Gators, Tony McClung. I'm going to miss people, so I should probably. But, you know, you need to go out and hear these world-class players, you know, and those are just drummers. So there's a great scene here, and guys come out of here. This is known as a great music town.
You've made several football references here, so now I feel compelled to ask you if you ever played in the marching band.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When I was at Ohio State, you know, I played in, and that's one thing I loved about the university. I had a chance. I played in the marching band, you know, the concert band with Dr. McGinnis, the symphony with, I'm embarrassed here, the conductor then, who was great, who taught me to like orchestral music, and I get a kick now. I'm doing all these pops concerts all over the place with orchestras. And then the jazz ensemble here at that time was outstanding. Tom Battenberg was a great director, musician. And that diverse skill set, I think, really helped contribute, I think, to, you know, your experience and making a living in a lot of different ways as a musician.
You could just spend all your time touring or playing with bands and orchestras. Why still teaching? Why do you like teaching?
Oh, I love seeing students who get it, and you see them grow that reward of their, you know, they get it and they succeed at that level. I had a graduate student this past semester who had some drum set, but there were some technical issues, and all of a sudden she got it. And I could see her start to smile and things opened up. And I always tell my students too that, you know, hopefully they get some things from me, but your students keep you young. You know, they bring in tracks and music that maybe I haven't heard, and it's, you know, it's a treat for me to learn from them. So it's rewarding, you know, just, and I love teaching. I actually have a music ed degree from Ohio State. Yeah.
I love that you just said she, because I think when people picture a drummer, they always picture a male. You have female students?
Oh, yeah, wonderful. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Historically, yeah, it's dominated by males, but obviously there's some incredible female drummers. Absolutely.
Wonderful. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time today. Do you have any shows coming up that you want to plug? I put you on the spot. You don't have your calendar open. It's okay.
Local. I'm doing some summer concerts with the Columbus Jazz Orchestra. Mm. Oh, we have a killing jazz club here in town, Ginger Rabbit, and I'm playing there with Andy Woodson and a great bassist, old friend, and a great jazz vibist, probably one of the great vibists in the world now, Rusty Burge out of Cincinnati Wednesday, May 14th. That's a great room. Once again, here's another, you know, that room will rival anything in New York. So that'd be a great place to come out.
That was Jim Rupp, who teaches at the who teaches in Ohio State's Jazz Studies Department at the School of Music, and he also plays with the Columbus and Cleveland Jazz Orchestras as well as the Cleveland Pops Orchestra. Jim, thanks so much for joining us today.
Super. Thank you for having me, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to travel down to Cincinnati and take a visit to the zoo. And that's when Fascinating Ohio continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you were going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. The Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden is the second oldest zoo in the United States. The zoo's director, Thane Maynard, is not just a zookeeper. He's also a radio host. He writes and hosts a program called The 90-Second Naturalist that's featured on Cincinnati Public Radio. He says 90 seconds is all you need to make an unexpected discovery about the natural world. And joining us now to talk for a little longer than 90 seconds is Cincinnati Zoo Director Thane Maynard. Welcome, Thane.
Hi, Amy. Thanks very much. And thanks for that nice introduction. It's fun to be on WOSU.
Yes, it's great to have you. You've been with the Cincinnati Zoo for nearly 50 years. Can you tell us?
I know. It's crazy. It's crazy. It doesn't feel that long, but zoos are a fun place to work. Yeah. So
50 years will fly by when it's at a zoo.
A little bit. You know, I think a lot of times if it works out for people, they sort of find a good fit. And if that's the case, time really does fly by. So I've been fortunate to have a zoo career, and Ohio, as you know, and your listeners know, has a lot of good zoos. Columbus Zoo, of course, is great. The Wilds, which they run, is great, but also good zoos in Cleveland, Toledo, Akron, and down here in Cincinnati.
Can you tell us how you got started at the Cincinnati Zoo?
You know, it was so long ago that it's really a different world in the zoo field than today. I was in graduate school at the University of Michigan, and realized I was over my head in a PhD program. So I got out with a master's degree. And concurrent with that, I got married to my college girlfriend. And so one day, you know, guys are not great planners. I literally woke up and said, I should probably find a job. So I had planned to go to Africa and bang around in a Land Rover or something, but instead I needed a job. And so by following a thread, I met a biology professor here in Cincinnati. My wife's from Cincinnati. And she said, well, I don't know where you'd find a job, but up at the Cincinnati Zoo, they're building this new education center. Maybe they need someone. And sort of one thing led to the next. They were finishing what at the time was the world's first zoo education center with five classrooms. And they did need some folks to help run programs and sort of right place, right time. And the reason I tell that is if it was today, with a couple of generations of kids who've grown up at zoos, you know, going to zoo camp, all that kind of thing, there'd be 300 qualified young people applying for that job. But then I was just fortunate I was here and it worked. And then we kind of went from there.
Where did your love for animals come from? From childhood?
Yes, I grew up in Central Florida back in the days before air conditioning. As a result, kids spent all their time outside because it's hot indoors in the summertime. And that meant you'd go down to lake or a creek. And once you're wet, of course, nobody's hot. So we spent a lot of time catching reptiles. Florida's full of reptiles. So, you know, lots of snakes and lizards and turtles. And once in a while, a baby alligator. But
Please tell me just a baby. Yeah.
Well, alligators were quite rare 60 years ago before they were protected by the Endangered Species Act. So it was difficult to find them. You had to go in the dark of night in really remote areas, not in town, with a big flashlight and shine, their eyes shine back red. And today, anyone who's listening who goes anywhere in the South, particularly Florida and Louisiana, you don't want to go out at night and get in the water, that's for sure. Because if you take a flashlight, you'll see nothing but alligator eyes.
Do you have a favorite animal at the zoo? I mean, I know you probably are not allowed to say, or it's like asking you to pick your favorite child, but I did wonder if there's a favorite spot for you at the Cincinnati Zoo.
Sure. Well, there are two answers. One is thinking of the zoo and the success we've had over the last 8 years. Everybody's favorite is Fiona, our hippo.
Yeah.
She was born premature. It was a surprise birth. And it was just one of these saved from the brink stories that really captivated people everywhere. I mean, to this day, even though she's grown, people come from all over the place just to see Fiona. So she's been really something, to tell you the truth. I think nobody ever thought hippos were cute until we had Fiona, and she actually was and still is. But my personal favorite still remains the American alligator. We have a number of gators here. We have a big female named Lucy in our manatee building. We have smaller ones, usually nicknamed Cruncher, that are small enough we can get out and show to the public and show to kids. And I just say gators because it reminds me of my youth, sort of a misspent youth outdoors.
You've also written several books, including one with famed biologist Jane Goodall. It's called Hope for Animals and Their World, How Endangered Species Are Being Rescued from the Brink. Tell us what it was like to work with Jane Goodall.
Well, you can imagine one of the honors of my life. Mm-hmm. Jane Goodall, what you see is what you get. You know, a lot of famous people, they have agents and spin doctors, and that's not the case. Jane's exactly the same woman she was 65 years ago when she went to the Gombe forest to study chimpanzees as a young woman, and just a remarkable person in every way. She's 91 years old now and still is out on the road speaking almost every night. If she comes to Columbus, she'll fill up, you know, the basketball arena with her message, and her message is about hope. And our book, Hope for Animals in Their World, grew out of that. When she came to the zoo years ago, we talked about it late into the night, because she felt it was true then, and it's truer now. There's so much bad news about nature that if you open up almost any newspaper or any magazine, you'll see all kinds of articles about either the destruction of the rainforests or the melting ice caps or climate change, extinction, etc. But there's a lot of good news too. There are more people than ever working to help save wildlife in wild places. There are smarter people than ever. And it's too soon to give up. There are a lot of success stories. And that's a heartening thing. I mentioned the Endangered Species Act. Thanks to that, species like bald eagles, alligators, peregrine falcons, gray whales, gray wolves, they're all healthy populations today. And just, you know, 50 something years ago, they were all very endangered species. So we can protect nature, but we have to try. We have to get after it. And that's good work, but we do need to tell more hopeful stories, not just depress people.
The zoo recently had some success with recovering the Mexican wolf population. Can you tell us about that?
Well, we're excited to be in one of the leadership roles with Mexican wolves. Mm-hmm. I think most folks probably know almost any endangered species today has a recovery plan. Mm-hmm. And those are where experts get together and say, okay, for this particular species, what's it going to take to bring it back? In the case of Mexican wolves, which we exhibit here, they are very endangered. They're a subspecies of the gray wolf, but they're a unique population, and it ranges through central Arizona, New Mexico, and also down, of course, into the country of Mexico. But their numbers went so far down that in the 70s and 80s, they were extinct in the wild. So there was just a remnant population in captivity. So with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, as well as with zoos, there's been breeding to bring those numbers back. And it's much like in the 80s, California condor, same thing, extinct in the wild, but they were brought back with captive breeding. So captive breeding isn't the only thing that will save a species like that, but it's essential in this case. So we're one of the zoos that breeds Mexican wolves, and they are one of the species that the naturalists out west have successfully taken brand new pups, teeny little pups, their eyes just barely open. They can fly them out west, and if the timing's right with a wild mother, they can sneak them into her den, and she'll raise them as wild pups. And what's so great about that, she'll raise them, and they'll be able to learn from her to hunt, where to have a den, how to get along, versus if they were raised in captivity by people and then later released as adults, they wouldn't really have that sort of savvy bush skills, if you will, of knowing how to exist in the wild. So it's a neat program. And there are a number of species that zoos today are working with in that same way of trying to bolster populations by breeding them. And again, working with people in either that native country or in our case, the folks from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service who are on the ground doing the work.
And your zoo is also celebrating a 150-year anniversary. How are you going to celebrate the birthday?
It's an exciting time. You know, Cincinnati, there's an old joke that the heyday in Cincinnati was in the 1870s. You know, Mark Twain was here and the riverboats and all that. And it's a little bit funny and a little bit true. But we are a town that really holds up these historic, venerable institutions like the Art Museum and our music hall and our musical arts. And, of course, the zoo. The zoo was established in 1873. It's been open every day since 1875. So we're doing all kinds of things. We've got activities for visitors. We're opening new exhibits. Later this summer, we're opening a new sea otter exhibit, as well as a new black bear exhibit, and really an emphasis on both the history of the zoo as well as what the future of zoos looks like. Zoos have come a long way in the last 150 years, and that certainly includes having a big reach in our community. Cincinnati Zoo, for instance, is the biggest draw in the city of Cincinnati, the biggest draw in Hamilton County. But more importantly, zoos also have a big impact all around the world.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides, and with us is Cincinnati Zoo Director Thane Maynard. And you have, I mentioned it in the intro, you have a 90-second radio program that has ran since 1987 called The 90-Second Naturalist. It's produced by Cincinnati Public Radio. So you say that in 90 seconds is all you need to make an unexpected discovery about the natural world. What made you decide to have a radio show?
You know, I was very fortunate by chance in 1987 to visit the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And I was giving some talks about wildlife. And back then you'd see handmade signs with it, like a magic marker. And there was a magic marker in the zoology department that said the next day, E.O. Wilson, many people say the most significant biologist since Charles Darwin, was going to be speaking. And Wilson was a very famous behavioral ecologist, an expert on ants, but also an author of amazing books. He's the only scientist that's ever won the Pulitzer Prize twice, which is quite a feat. Because you don't win the Pulitzer Prize for science, you win it for writing.
Right.
So I was able to stay and listen to him talk. And he was getting older at that time. And he said, I hope I'm not disappointing, but I'm not going to talk about my research. He said, I'm in the narrative phase of my career. And he said to the group, scientists need to take the message of conservation, protecting biodiversity to the street. They need to take it everywhere, not just write in journal articles. But he said they need to have radio programs, they need to have TV programs, they need to have articles in the newspaper talking about why protecting nature is important to people as well as wildlife. And so I'm sitting there in a room full of scientists thinking, well, you know, I'm not going to grow up to be a famous scientist, but I can tell stories, so let's do it. And one thing led to the next. And in that summer, we did start the show. I came up with the idea of that name. It was sort of an alliteration. But the premise was people have a short attention span. And of course, 38 years later, we have an even shorter attention span. I do think if the show was 5 minutes long, folks would change the channel in their car. But it has been a lot of fun because you can share an awful lot of stories. It airs in most markets 5 days a week. It airs in a lot of smaller markets like Bozeman, Montana, and Billings, Montana, and stations in Virginia. I don't think we're on WOSU, but you're welcome to run it if you can. It's free.
No, I'm sorry. I'll talk to the program director about that, though.
The humor is on big stations, they tend to have enough people to run their own shows. Mm. A lot of small stations are glad to have those little interstitials.
Yeah. Now, I can't let you leave without talking about some babies. Your zoo is celebrating the month of May by talking about all the babies being born at the zoo. You're having a baby boom. And everyone loves to celebrate baby animals. What do you have on the way?
You know, it's a fun time, indeed. Everybody comes to the zoo, any ages. I joke, everybody that goes to Kroger goes to the zoo. But our bread and butter is families with young kids. And you're right, they do love babies. We're very fortunate this year. We have three cheetah cubs that are youngsters, three females, and they're living together. And when they grow up, they'll be part of our cheetah encounter where we run the cheetahs full speed. But at this point, they're still very cute and very playful and not as lazy as their parents just sitting in the shade.
Is that Lulu, Zola, and Pink? Is that?
It is, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. And they... I walked by them today and they're a crowd pleaser for sure. One of our most famous animals, Gladys, the gorilla, is pregnant. And that's significant because there was a day when I first started in the zoo business, basically it was like a farm. You just bred whatever you had. Today, scientists realize you can't do that because most of these animals aren't ever going to come out of the wild. And so you need to be very careful who breeds with whom. For genetic reasons. And then also, if you have babies, they have to have somewhere for them to go. You can't just have an endless capacity of whether that's cheetahs or gorillas or whatever. So it's fun to get a breeding recommendation. We've had 51 successful gorilla births here, and hopefully this will be our 52nd later this year. Our cheetah breeding program is a really strong one, much like at the wilds that people might be familiar with. They have a great cheetah program there. We've had 72 successful births of cheetahs out at our breeding farm out in the country. Oh, we also have some young reptiles. We have a young rhinoceros viper from the Congo, which is a very cool snake. We have a young rattlesnake called the Aruba Island rattlesnake. Again, one, it's endemic to that one island and it's endangered. We have countless numbers of baby insects. We have the world's first insectarium that's been open almost 50 years. And we've got everything from beetles to crazy leaf-tailed gecko, leaf-tailed katydids in there. Yeah, so that's a fun area with all sorts of babies. We have three young manatees. Like Columbus Zoo, we're part of the manatee rescue program. Mm-hmm. So we'll end up with ones that have been orphaned and they'll stay at the zoo until they get a little bigger.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there and we'll have to send our listeners down to Cincinnati to see all those babies throughout the rest of the summer and as they grow. I want to thank you so much for your time. Cincinnati
Amy,
Zoo.
Thank you.
Yeah. Cincinnati Zoo Director Thane Maynard. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Amy.
This has been Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jarovich.